This is the April 24th, 2015 edition of WFAE Talks. I'm Greg Collard, the news director at WFAE, and I'm joined by education reporter Lisa Wharf. Hello, Lisa.
Hello.
It's been a while since we've done this, hasn't it?
It has been.
Yeah. Did you miss it?
Oh, I sometimes think of Monday. Oh, we didn't do it on Friday.
Yeah. Our fans have been demanding WFA Talks come back.
that would be overstating it.
that laugh you heard is the voice of money and influence reporter Tom Bullock. And this is the second time you've done something like this. You did some other reporter roundtable for TV today, didn't you?
I did. But this will be far more fun.
This will be far more fun. Yeah. Off the record on WTVI.
Yep. Strange name.
Strange name, yes. You're going to be on TV next week, too, on cable.
Right? I am. I'm going to be, I'm making all the rounds. I'm going to be doing Capital Tonight with Time Warner Cable.
All right. What are you going to be talking about?
I have no idea yet. I'm assuming something with Raleigh. It'll be a little crazy next week because we've got the dreaded crossover deadline coming up, which is basically, it means that, you know, a bill has to be passed by one of the two chambers in order to still be in the running to become law during the session. So there'll be a mad dash. It's already underway, but it's really going to hit full steam starting next week, which reminds me, I should probably just plan on being here for crazy, crazy nights next week.
Well, that's one reason it's been crazy. So that's one reason we haven't had as many of these podcasts lately. But fortunately, we all have a little bit of time today. So let's get to it. This week, you were at the federal courthouse in Charlotte covering the sentencing hearing for General David Petraeus. First, what was it? What was the circus like?
Well, the circus was definitely in town, and it's not surprising given the stature of David Petraeus. I mean, a lot of people will remember him as a four-star general. He started with the 101st when he still had one star and was kind of this bright beacon of hope for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as all kinds of things just started falling apart. The area they controlled, which is Mosul, really was working, and it was relatively peaceful. And everybody started to note that he was doing things incredibly differently. At one point, I remember going up there the first time I met him. I was NPR's Baghdad bureau chief, and I went up with Deborah Amos and wanted to interview this general who was really making some waves by doing some things that the U.S. military just doesn't normally do. And the first thing I noticed driving up was that the lights were on. Mm-hmm. On the street lamps as we drove into Mosul. And it sounds like a little thing, but don't forget that at the time, Iraq had these epic power outages. There just wasn't enough power to go around to, you know, for lights and everything else. But the lights were on in Mosul. And we found out one of the big reasons was because under David Petraeus, he had he basically had his own foreign policy. Without asking anyone's permission, he had contacted Syria, reestablished trade officially under between Iraq and Iraq and Syria, and he had come to an agreement with the Syrian power company to ship some of their power to Mosul. And it's one of the things that people, the Iraqis there, really appreciated, because, you know, power is kind of important. And then of course he went on to lead the surges in both Iraq and Afghanistan, became director of the CIA. Yesterday he was in Charlotte to plead guilty to letting his mistress, Paula Broadwell, have access to these 8 black notebooks that he kept with this incredible amount, it sounds like, of classified information, everything from, you know, the names of covert operatives to the notes of personal discussions he had with presidents, war strategies, I mean, discussions at the National Security Council, really, really high-level stuff. So everybody, all the media was in town to basically see what he would say and what he looked like. And he looked the same as he always did. He obviously wasn't in uniform. It was really just kind of this simple blue suit. And, you know, he was sentenced. The sentence, I'm sure, is going to be a little controversial. And I think it should be. 2 years probation and $100,000 fine. And in fact, he wasn't actually charged with the worst offense that he could be found guilty of, which was actually providing this classified information to someone who did not have clearance to see it. He was only charged with and pled guilty to one count of having that information at all, the fact that he kept the notebooks.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, if he had been charged with providing confidential classified material to someone who could not see it, what would What would that punishment be?
Yeah. It really matters on the count. I mean, first of all, if you think about it, it matters on how the Justice Department would treat it. Let's start with the number of notebooks. It could have been one charge for each of the notebooks. Yeah. It could have been one charge for each of the key classified information tidbits that were in each of those notebooks. But if you go back, I mean, you know, not too long ago, a CIA operative leaked to the press proof that you know, the CIA had been involved in waterboarding. He got a 30-month sentence. David Petraeus, 2 years probation. And it's not even a regular 2 years probation. He can still travel freely internationally.
30-month or 13-month?
No, the case I'm talking about now is 30-month.
Okay.
There's another case of a State Department arms expert who leaked information on North Korea's nuclear program to—and yes, I did say nuclear. It's a Utahism. I can't get over it. to Fox News. He got 13 months. And, in fact, in that case, the one you're talking about, Stephen Kim is his name, Greg, mm-hmm. and— Petraeus had this really interesting quote where he praised the sentence and said, you know, oaths matter. Oaths are hold you accountable, and you must be accountable to those oaths. And you have to, you know, be left wondering whether David Petraeus, because he was this great general, because he was this kind of towering figure, mm-hmm. Whether or not he received a lighter treatment by the Justice Department.
Is he getting credit for the good he did?
I think partially. I mean, when it comes down to it, the judge yesterday, David Kiesler, basically said he has to weigh the infraction. He has to weigh the crime and the character of the defendant. And just that sentence alone, I think, shows a whole lot. It shows that he's not just focused on the act. He is focused on both. There's a balancing act, that the sentence not only has to fit the crime, but the person should be allowed leniency in some way if they have risen to a certain level. And that's actually not uncommon. Judges often consider that. I mean, that's why sometimes people get lighter sentences for a first offense, or why, you know, it's important in criminal cases during the sentencing phase to hear from people who speak up on behalf of the defendant. And Petraeus got, like, I think it was 34 letters that were filed on his behalf. They wouldn't tell us who they were from, but they said it was heads of state, former and current high-level military people, and some soldiers who actually just, you know, served under Petraeus in either Iraq or Afghanistan. So it's not uncommon for character to be weighed when you're considering a sentence. But how much that weighed the sentence, I'm sure, is going to be talked about for a while.
Why did the case go through Charlotte?
Yeah, there's a lot of people who wonder that because—
I mean, it didn't happen.
It didn't happen in Charlotte. Here. No, but I mean, the interesting thing to me is the when the whole case again revolves around these eight notebooks. Petraeus had them. He let his mistress Paula Broadwell see them, but that happened in a D.C. residence, right in Washington D.C. But then the way that everything kind of unfolded here, I mean, Petraeus originally resigned not because of the notebooks, but because it was discovered he was having an extramarital affair. The FBI and the CIA discovered this because Paula Broadwell has allegedly or had allegedly been sending these emails to Jill Kelly, who was, if you can follow along here, who was in Tampa, Florida, and happened to be involved in military circles there. And it's alleged that Broadwell saw her as a romantic rival when it came to Petraeus. So she basically tried to protect her turf, as it were. What most people probably don't know is that the FBI has a pretty sizable cyber division, right? They investigate cyber crimes. That's based here in Charlotte. And so because of these emails that led them to this idea, the cyber unit here in Charlotte started investigating, and then they raided Paula Broadwell's house, mm-hmm. and they found this information on computers, which again would go through not only the FBI here, but because of the cyber division here. So all roads seem to point to Charlotte. And the final reason it was here was because David Petraeus, in his plea agreement that he reached in February with the Justice Department, said, I waive a right to venue. So he could have picked somewhere else, or they could have challenged for somewhere else, but he agreed. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you have the former director of the CIA, this former four-star general, showing up in Uptown to get sentenced for crimes against the United States.
So is he going to have to come back here as far as probation, or how does that
no,
work?
No, probation will be based on where he lives.
Okay.
And so it's probably, unless he is, he's a high-priced, highly paid speaker right now. He's actually on the speaking circuit. He's also works for a hedge fund to advise.
Yeah.
There's lots of stuff that he's doing. It's one of the reasons I think the judge kind of alluded to this, so it's not just speculation, that the judge upped the fine because Petraeus I mean, the rumors are that Petraeus could easily make the originally suggested $40,000 fine in one speaking engagement. So I think that's one of the reasons.
Make him work a little for it.
Yeah, exactly.
two speeches. A little.
Two and a half.
Well, what was the damage done by this? Does that matter?
It does matter, and that's another thing that came up in court, and no one really knows. I mean, right now, everybody seems to agree, first of all, that Broadwell saw all of that information. I mean, again, they found it on her computers. That's not really in doubt. But it doesn't appear to have been excised from her book, since the CIA would have had the ability to go through that book and take out anything they deemed to be classified. And the CIA says they didn't take out any information. And there doesn't seem to be any other way that this information made it out into the wild. So it looks like everything really did stay between Petraeus and Broadwell. That does count in theory. It does count because no specific damage was done to the United States or national security, right? Because it just stayed in between. It was an indiscretion. It's one of the things that the Justice Department said as to why their plea agreement seemed to be a little light. But the law is very particular. It's Title 18. It's known in some cases as the Espionage Act. It doesn't dictate whether the information actually was used to harm the United States. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even say whether the intent had to be there to harm the United States or their interests. All the law says is that the information was shared, or in this case, mishandled. That's it. So I think it mattered to sentencing, but if you want to go under a strict reading of the law, it shouldn't have mattered.
Well, before we go on to the next topic, I got to ask, since you were in Iraq and Afghanistan when David Petraeus was in charge of things over there, was it just surreal seeing him
so weird.
In this situation then?
Yes. It was so crazy. I mean, truly, truly bizarre. I'm standing there, and he came up the side, right? I mean, there was a big scrum of reporters at the front entrance of the federal building in Uptown. You know, all the cameras were set up over there. And we see this car go by and kind of slow down and then kind of speed up and take that right turn. So he came up the side entrance. And of course, everybody runs over, and all of them, including myself, are sitting there snapping pictures and trying to jostle for position. But at one point, I just looked, and I'm sitting there staring at a guy who, you know, I helped to cover his confirmation hearing. I've sat across from him in different war zones. I've sat in a helicopter with him as we were touring. You know, he was talking about what he did that was different in America. I've read the counterinsurgency manual that he famously helped to pen. And it was just so bizarre to think I'm sitting here in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm no longer covering foreign news. I stepped away from that a while ago. It was just so funny how everything just – Charlotte is – it's a fascinating place, and the world's a funny place because you just never know what's going to happen here or anywhere. And it was – it really – Greg, it really was surreal. It just I had a laugh. And actually, a friend of mine who is in Pakistan for NPR right now just wrote me. He's like, how weird was it? I was like, dude, really strange.
All right. Well, on to the next topic, education, specifically charter schools. Lisa, you had an interesting report this week. 18 more charter schools get approval. The Charter School Advisory Board recommended 18 of 40. And most interestingly, there 9 of them, of those 18, are going to be run by for-profit businesses.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so last year, I mean, this is an increase from what we saw last year. Last year, there were 71 groups that applied for schools, and the recommendation and the final vote was on 11 of them, and one of them was a for-profit company. And, you know, over the last couple of years, since the cap on charter schools was lifted from 100, you know, you've seen a lot of pressure from state lawmakers on how many schools get approved, and you know what kind of schools they are, and actually the board before this is a new board. They've been around for 2 years, and they're an advisory group that makes the recommendation, and then the State Board of Education pretty much follows,
rubber stamps.
Follows what they do. And so the previous advisory group was not approving enough charters, and they were approving something like 26 a year, actually. I think the last year they were in existence. And, you know, the state lawmakers gutted the board and replaced the board. And, you know, it replaced them. There are some of the same people on the board. Most of them are charter school operators. But they got a board that was even more stringent. And so last year, after they recommended 11 schools, only one for profit, the education committee, the Senate Education Committee, hauled in the guy who oversees the Office of Charter Schools and said, your people have to do a better job. And, you know, for-profit companies was one of the things Senator Jerry Tillman said, hey, look, you know, we feel you're biased against these. And, you know, we need to open up the state to these schools. I mean, if you see that they have a good track record in other states, then they should be able to open up a school here.
Is there a general feeling among some lawmakers, though, that just for-profit charter schools are the way to go, that they are better? Whether or not it's for-profit an important issue to some lawmakers?
Well, it's interesting in the sense, you know, like I was talking with Helen Nance, who's the chairwoman of this group that oversees, that does all the recommending of charter schools, and she runs her own charter school. It is an independent charter school, and I asked her about this, you know, this feeling for for-profit charters, and she said, And this is also something, you know, we've had a number of charter schools close very abruptly, not even making it through a year. And she said, you know, back when I opened my charter school, we got $50,000 from the federal government to start up the charter school. And, you know, finances have been a big reason that these schools have closed. You know, they're not getting the enrollment they expect. Now, when you have a for-profit company coming and starting a charter school, They have a lot of finances to back them up. And so you wouldn't see necessarily a for-profit school close as quickly. And I think that that probably sounded like it was going through some minds as well.
Nothing like deep pockets to help you start. But I'm curious, you know, you bring up a really, really good point, which is enrollment was dropping. Enrollment was not as high, right? I shouldn't say it's dropping, but it wasn't as high as anticipated. So why this push then? I mean, if you would think supply and demand would come into play at some point, you know? Why do they keep wanting to open more and more and more if the ones they've got just...
Well, yeah, and see, it's kind of two different philosophies of charter schools coming in play. And you have one group and that says, basically, we need to open as many charter schools as we possibly can, and the good ones will be good, and they'll stay open. And the bad ones will, in the words of Senator Tillman, will die on the vine. And that competition is good. But it's sometimes very hard to figure out which charter schools are good ones and which aren't.
And there are students in between that can be penalized for that, too.
Then it closes mid-year, and, you know, that's not a good situation for anyone. And no one, I think, wants that situation when they're saying that. And then you have the group that says, we need to be very good at picking out the best charter schools possible. And we don't want failures, and so we're going to do a lot of screening. And then you have sort of in between that says, hey, all charter schools aren't great when they start out, but they can become great with a couple years' experience.
Well, the chairwoman of the advisory board, Helen Nance, you had an interesting exchange with her. She clearly isn't sold on all 18 of these charters that got approval. Let's listen to that exchange you had with Hearst, and we'll hear your voice first.
Do you feel good about the recommendations?
I feel really good about some of the schools I'm excited about.
How many schools are you not excited about?
I don't know. I just think some schools are stronger than others.
That is just great radio. That is just, that's, wow.
She was definitely careful with her words.
But you can tell,
you can tell a lot with a laugh.
With how the question is answered. So were there a lot of close votes? I mean, does it look like there was a lot of controversy around some of these schools that were approved?
Yeah, I mean, I went back through the files, and I have, there's two I didn't get to of the 18. They just posted a few more this week. But from what I've seen so far, there were two real close votes. something like it's 11 members on the board. It was, you know, 5-6 on these two votes. One was for Charlotte Classical School. There were concerns that they didn't really understand what the curriculum would be that would, you know, communicate this education.
What makes it classical?
Are we talking about literature?
We are not talking about music. Okay. But yeah, there was definitely in the notes you see around these decisions, there were some questions about what does that actually look like as a curriculum. And you see this with charter schools that are trying to open in Charlotte, that Charlotte has so many charter schools. And so there's always concerns about enrollment, you know? Are you gonna get the enrollment that you need? So that was that, I think, also went into that concern. And then the other one was it's called Town Center Charter. It's planned for Gaston County, and it's run by a for-profit company. It's for at-risk students and those students who have already dropped out of school to basically. It's kind of like a blended classroom setting. You take a bunch of sort of online courses with help around you. And Charlotte actually already has one. They want to open one in Wake. That got approval too. But for some reason, this was a close vote for the Gaston County one.
Are these public companies that run these schools?
So yeah, some of them are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how much money is there in education in charter schools?
I mean, there's a lot. I mean, certainly when you look at, you know, getting $6,000 per student, $7,000 per student, I mean, that's a lot of money. And, you know, one thing that people have looked at is marketing budgets, for example, you know, how much these schools spend on marketing, which is kind of a important part of the school if you want kids to go to it, you know, but yeah, those marketing budgets can be big, but yes, this is certainly a big area.
Well, with this influx
for profits,
with this influx of for-profit businesses running schools, it makes me wonder if we're going to have a new powerful lobbying arm in Raleigh, where on behalf of per student funding.
Well, you already have lobbyists for these mm-hmm. for-profit charter companies in Raleigh right now.
Advocating for increased funding for students?
I don't know.
That's what I meant. If it's a way to get more funding for
people cost in the classroom.
I would assume that may be a part of it. You know, mm-hmm. for example, there are, and this was by lawmakers, you know, they said you got to approve two virtual charter schools. So these are charter schools where you work out of your home. A student, you know, has their computer and they do everything online. And, you know, one of the arguments was, hey, it's an online charter school. They shouldn't get as much money. And mm-hmm. so you bet there were people in Raleigh saying, no, this we need just as much money. It costs just as much. And yes. So those conversations are going on.
And just going with the like cost of pupil and just the general cost, when these schools do fail, and you have these students who are kind of left scrambling, what happens? Like, how hard is it for CMS or other school districts to kind of bring them back in?
Yeah, and it partly depends on the time of year that it happens.
Sure.
But most of these schools, you know, for example, what is the name? Was it Student First that closed last April? And there was 2 months of school left. CMS wasn't,
They didn't get any funding for those students.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, early on in the year, you know, you would probably get some funding if you were absorbing them. And if you were a school that had a bunch more, you would get that funding. But, you know, for one or two students, you don't always get that funding, that extra funding.
And then are schools held accountable for those test scores when they that might be not be as good as the overall mm-hmm. population when
sure.
you just take them on mid-year like that?
Sure.
Interesting stuff. Good reporting as always. What are you going to be working on? I know you're working on some interesting projects for the next couple weeks.
Yeah. So right now, working on a story about HBCUs, historically Black colleges, and their situation in North Carolina. And that will, I mean, there's a huge amount to talk about there. But it's going to be sort of a jumping off piece for Charlotte Talks on Thursday. So.
And Tom, I know you're going to be busy with the legislature. I already talked about you.
Yeah.
Have fun. Yeah, I'll enjoy my late nights editing your story, too. So, all right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.